This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks for 2019 with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
Alex Crook from TalkSport and national newspaper journalist.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV Sport.
And I'm Steve Wilson.
Coming up this week is Chelsea manager Maurizio Sarri beginning to show the signs of the strain.
The best managerial excuses for losing games. We've had loads of them this weekend. And we find out if Crook succeeded in his mission to cover two games in different parts of the country in one day.
And Sam swaps his Premier League stat pack for his sequins to give us an insight into life as Dancing on Ice commentator.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Right, the football's been busy this week, but Sam has been busy combining his usual football commentary with ice skating commentary. Sam, Dancing on Ice, you are back as the commentator. Tell me all about Gemma Collins, please.
I thought she was bloody brilliant in comparison to what I saw in rehearsal. I watched her do that routine
five
times.
Wow, how bad was she in rehearsal?
She stacked it on almost every single run. That's what she did. So staying up on her skates was an achievement. And we are talking about excuses, managerial excuses, about why things happen, why you lost games a little bit later in the programme. I've got a cracking excuse for you from Dancing on Ice this weekend, but we'll get there a little bit later on.
So Gemma Collins skating on thin ice this weekend, but a host of Premier League teams were frozen out of the FA Cup. But let's take a look at those big headlines in numbers.
It was shock Sunday after Fulham and Leicester crashed out to Oldham and Newport County respectively in the space of just a few hours. The first time two top flight teams have lost to sides from the fourth tier on the same day since way back in 1979.
Raheem Sterling was among the scorers for Manchester City as they thumped Rotherham by 7-0. The England winger has scored or assisted 101 goals in his 167 appearances for the champions.
And Bournemouth's recent slump continued as they lost 3-1 at home to Brighton. The Cherries have not beaten top-tier opponents in the FA Cup since they're in Division 3 and knocked out the then-holders Manchester United way back in 1984.
Yeah, Harry Redknapp doesn't like to talk about that, though. Huddersfield's horrendous season went from bad to worse as the Premier League's bottom club lost 1-0 at home to Championship Bristol City, extending their run of defeats to a club record 9 in a row.
Romelu Lukaku just loves the FA Cup, doesn't he? After netting in Manchester United's 2-0 win at home to Reading, the big Belgian has now scored 13 times in his last 14 games in the competition.
League One Accrington Stanley heaps more misery on Championship strugglers Ipswich as Billy Keyes scored the only goal in a 1-0 win since the Tractor Boys last won an FA Cup game. Spain, Germany and France have all won the World Cup.
That's a brilliant stat. That is superb.
That is one of my favourite stats so far, I think. A tough weekend then for lots of the big clubs. No sympathy for certain managers, Eddie Howe and Claude Puel, for naming understrength teams when they're safe in the Premier League. But Michelle, one manager you know very well is Mike Flynn. You must have been delighted for him.
We went down last week and did a feature for Soccer Saturday at Newport, just knowing that that sort of fixture has the potential to throw up an upset. Of course, Newport beat Leeds 2-1 in the third round last year, and then they held Tottenham 1-1 in the fourth round, got that big replay at Wembley. But Mike was saying on Thursday, it's just, there's something about it, it's just that magic that he just fancied it a little bit. You know, obviously, Leicester supposedly had all those big players, but Claude Puel didn't play a lot of them. Perhaps that tells you how he was approaching the FA Cup, but he was excited about it, and I texted him after and he said the atmosphere was amazing. And Mike Flynn, just a little side note, has done wonders at Newport because they were on the brink of going out of the Football League a couple of seasons ago. He came in for the last 12 games, took over, kept them up just on the final day, and he's doing a great job there. They've got around the third lowest budget in the whole of the Football League, and this money for them now will do wonders, although I'm not too sure how impressed they'd be, with all due respect, drawing Middlesbrough away. I know he was hoping for one of the big boys like Liverpool, which obviously wouldn't have happened because then they lost to Wolves or Manchester United, but you know, it's still money for the club, and hopefully they'll get on telly and they'll get something from that.
That Middlesbrough one's interesting only for the fact that Tony Pulis comes from South Wales, I think, as well.
Yeah, he's from Cardiff. Yeah,
so that's a sort of good little hook. But Leicester City, Claude Puel, I gave him a bit of criticism in the League Cup when they played Manchester City and they decided that they were going to rest most of their first team for that. They could have beaten Manchester City that night. They didn't. And they went out of the League Cup at the quarterfinal stage. I gave them a bit of criticism because I said, stupidly probably, that they're not going to beat Chelsea, Manchester City in the next upcoming Premier League games. They could end up winning the Carabao Cup, so what are they doing? Look, they did win those two games. They beat Everton as well over the festive period. They picked up those 9 points, which is great. Okay, fast forward to January. They're in the third round of the FA Cup. They've got now guaranteed safety next season. There's no chance they're going to break into the top six, top four. So they're not going to get into Europe any other way than by winning a trophy. So surely you go hell for leather for it, right?
It's what confuses me about teams like Leicester. It is their chance of winning a trophy. The League Cup, yeah, the softest penalty shootout you'll ever see. And then you're thinking the FA Cup, Newport, with respect to Newport, is a very winnable tie. You put your best squad out, you put your Jamie Vardys out, you put players that can just get you a comfortable win, not have to strain, not have to worry about injuries too much, get it done in sort of 60 minutes, then take them off. You'd think that's how a logical manager would think, but no, Leicester see a genuine chance of winning a trophy, go begging.
He's not the only manager who'll feel the heat, though, this weekend. There'll be a few of them. Eddie Howe is another one who will be looked at after changing his team. But you've got a story, Crook, from the tunnel at Stamford Bridge / St Mary's, haven't you?
Well, it came from Chelsea's game against Southampton, the last Premier League match, which, of course, they toiled to a 0-0 draw. I wasn't there, but I've heard from a very good source from another journalist that Maurizio Sarri came up with that great line, didn't he, into the Match of the Day interview, where he said he knew nothing about the signing of Christian Pulisic until the deal had been completed. Well, I have it on very good authority that Chelsea tried to get Match of the Day to pull that interview. They weren't happy at all with what Maurizio Sarri said. Clearly they saw it as some kind of slight against the board and an example of some discord between Sarri and his paymasters. Match of the Day, to be fair, stuck to their guns. They refused to pull the interview on the basis that it was actually being beamed live to all of the Premier League's overseas broadcasters. So they were free to clip it up and put it out within seconds of Sarri saying it. So they saw no reason to pull it themselves. But I think it's really interesting. We know what happens there. We've seen it with the likes of Jose Mourinho and, of course, Antonio Conte last season. When a manager strays from the party line, normally the exit is not too far away. And the person who told me this had been told from another very good source at Chelsea that Sarri is on very dodgy ground there and could well be the next Premier League manager to lose his job.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think you and I had a conversation about him and his relationship with some of the players there. And I know for a fact that there is a situation where there's players like Danny Drinkwater, for example, who are not getting any minutes, not getting any time on the pitch and actually not being used properly in training either. I think when they do shape work and stuff like that, he's pushed to the side. And Callum Hudson-Odoi was in that group as well, where they were training, the first team were training. Whenever they did any sort of shape work, they excluded him, which I think probably precipitated this whole situation we got now, where Bayern Munich are thinking we could probably grab him on the cheap and he's a good potential player for the future. And Chelsea's hierarchy are saying, hold on a second, no, we don't want him to go. You know, even the Tammy Abraham thing that has happened in the last few hours, that he's going to stay at Aston Villa now and he's not going to go to Wolves on loan, is another sort of interesting situation, because a lot of people were thinking that Chelsea were going to sell him. I mean, from my point of view, I don't understand why Chelsea don't just bring back Tammy Abraham and put him up front. He's not going to score less goals than Alvaro Morata or Olivier Giroud, is he?
Yeah, exactly. And I know he wasn't very good at Swansea last year, and people are saying, oh, but he had his chance in the Premier League. Swansea were dire last year. If you had Tammy Abraham in that Chelsea team, he's going to score goals. Like you say, Sam, he can't be any worse than what they've got right now. And that whole saga, the way that's played out, is he going to Wolves? Is he not? Is he staying on loan at Villa? And the sort of the way, I just don't think it's right, the way a player can be loaned to two clubs in one season.
I don't think you can be. He's played for Chelsea this campaign. I don't think you can play for three clubs, and I wonder whether or not one of the reasons that this has actually collapsed is because they've realised that there's a FIFA ruling that you can't play for three clubs in the same season.
I just wonder how we judge Maurizio Sarri. I mean, Sam, you're in a good position. Are they any better off now than they were this time last year under Antonio Conte? I mean, they qualified for the Europa League then. I think they're going to miss out on the top four again. I do think United now, with the momentum they built up under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, can nab that fourth place. Of
Hold
course, they're still
second.
In the League
That's
Cup.
That's a bit optimistic, isn't it? Six I mean, points. Crikey, they're 6 points behind at the moment, and Chelsea are comfortably in fourth position. I'm not sure about that at all. I think they've definitely made progress. They've changed. Well, yeah, they've changed system. They play more attacking football. They had played a lot more attacking football. I do think, actually, in recent weeks, it's become a bit dull to watch them. There's a lot of passing for passing's sake. Beautifully crisp passing, and they play out from the back. But that playing out from the back, breaking a press, moving up the pitch and exposing the fact that they've outnumbered the opponents once they get into the opponent's half only happens once or twice in a game. And if you don't take that chance, the rest of the match can be a bit of a drudge.
Mm. The other Sarri story I was told as well, by the way, just on the subject of post-match interviews, his very first game, he didn't want to do the Sky television interview. He said he would only speak to Sky Italia. And the Sky reporter said, well, you know, Sky Italia clearly are not here. And he said, OK, I'll give you one answer, and then I'm answering the rest in Italian. Doesn't sound like the easiest bloke to deal with.
He's actually, it was fine. And I was I was at that first game, or I was definitely at the second game when they played Arsenal. And he didn't want to do as much media as you have to do in the Premier League. But I'm afraid the Premier League has its demands, and there is a list and you have to follow it. And there's no... You don't get away with it. Gone are the days where Sir Alex Ferguson could just turn around and say, I'm not doing this or I'm not doing that. It doesn't work like that anymore, I'm afraid. There's contracts in place.
Although Nuno gets away with it at Wolves, doesn't he? I've been told...
Doesn't get away with local, television.
The local BBC radio who cover Wolves have stopped even bothering to do Nuno post-match. They do players instead because he's so difficult for them to interview. He gives one-word answers, makes it clear he doesn't want to be there. That's disappointing, that, when you look at the fact his side are playing such good football. They're one of the stories of the season, and he doesn't want to help with that narrative.
He was like that last season as well, though, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a little... Look, I speak as you're fine, and he was always okay with me, but sometimes, you know, we're on Sky Sports News, and I'm watching these presses come in live, and our reporters sat there, and I just feel for them, because they're getting one-word answers, two-word answers. He's being a little bit awkward. Like, why be like that? You're a manager of a Premier League club. You're doing a brilliant job. You've done brilliantly to get them promoted. Why would you be like that? I don't know. I just don't understand it.
Maybe it's because he used to work with Jose Mourinho.
Learn from who? Yeah.
Okay, I'm sure we could debate this all day, but we're not going to do that. If you want to follow us on our Instagram or Twitter, you can do. This is how you do it.
Yep. If you find us on both, you'll find us at AFC Geeks. The handles are exactly the same.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, it's time to introduce this week's guest geek. He is one of the main voices on Match of the Day and last season commentated on his first FA Cup final. Sam caught up with the BBC Steve Wilson ahead of Arsenal's win at Blackpool on Saturday.
Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the AFC Geeks podcast this week is none other than Steve Wilson. Thank you very much for coming on.
Hello, Sam.
Nice to see you.
Thank you very much. Nice to be asked.
And we're up here in Blackpool.
Yeah.
Just about to do the Blackpool-Arsenal game. And the last time I was here, actually, I think they were in the Premier League, Blackpool. Nothing much has really changed, has it? Apart from the pitch has got a lot worse.
Yeah, the pitch looks pretty grim, actually, doesn't it? Yeah, I mean, obviously, they've had all kinds of really, really sort of massive disconnect between the fans and the ownership here. Mm. And it's been going on for a long time. So... I don't know about you, Sam. I think the most optimistic estimation I've heard of Blackpool fans here today is about 4,000.
Yeah, that's the average crowd, isn't it, now?
Yeah, yeah.
We've got a few more on New Year's Day for the Sunderland game, but that was Sunderland fans.
So many, which was great.
So it'll be interesting to see how many people turn up here tonight. Your commentary position is over on the far side, is that right?
Yeah, we'll be right over on the far side of the ground, just in front of the big black plush seats that are just out of shot, actually. But I'm assuming that they're the Oyston family seats. And we'll be right in front of those, possibly in the line of a load of rotten cabbages and tomatoes.
What's it like commentating at these FA Cup grounds, these League One grounds? Because, I mean, this isn't one of those that you would necessarily associate with being a more difficult commentary position, but it is quite bare and it's very close to the sea.
Well, I mean, this will be fine because this stadium was kind of configured for Premier League standards when they were up 8-9 years ago, whatever it was. I mean, I have experienced some very hairy ones where you're up a wet ladder on a freezing cold day onto some platform which has been knocked up by the night before by some very good riggers. I should stress that they're all very good and very conscious of health and safety. But yeah, you know, if you get a horrible night, Sutton United, when they played Arsenal in the fifth round of the FA Cup, you know, luckily it was windy, but it wasn't wet, because if it had been wet, I think notes and everything would just be soaked within seconds, you know. And that would be sort of fairly typical of a non-league, I suppose. I don't know if you remember years ago, Chasetown, who were in the Midlands Alliance Senior League at the time, played Oldham in the FA Cup first round. That was a live game on the BBC. And they had a fourth qualifying round replay against Blyth at their ground at Chasetown, which I went to go and see, and they won. Everyone expected Blyth to go through, club with cup history and everything. Chasetown's ground was a little stand that held about 50 people and a rope around the pitch, and that was their ground. And heaven and earth was moved by that wonderful football club to get the BBC in, tarmacking the car park so that the trucks could come in, building scaffolding, building temporary stands. The community pulled together. And that, for me, that Chasetown-Oldham game is the most memorable game I've probably ever done in the FA Cup, because a club with an average home attendance of less than 100 took 4,000 to Oldham for a replay. And that's what the FA Cup can do.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I think we love it. I mean, I remember before they became a Football League club, actually, I was just up the road here at Fleetwood Town. And yeah. I remember doing it. It was either an ITV highlights game or it was live on ITV. I can't remember. But there's a tiny little box which is placed on top of the main stand. And you have to climb up on a ladder,
yeah.
go across the roof, and then go into your little box. And you just sat there on your own for about two or 3 hours. Brilliant. Yeah. Great. Yeah. And it's very windy up here, isn't it?
I think people imagine sometimes, not in the FA Cup maybe, but in the Premier League, people imagine that you're often behind glass being served Prosecco and prawns. And obviously, as you know, the reality could not be more different. If it's raining, you get wet. If it's windy, you get blown. If it's snowing, you get cold. And that's the same everywhere. And actually, I wouldn't have it any other way from a commentary point of view, because when you are in those few stadiums, that the old Parc des Princes was one of them, when you're behind glass, you feel so removed from the action that it's very difficult to get involved in the atmosphere of the game, because you are literally in a goldfish bowl. And that, I think that is the worst way to commentate on a game.
We went to Tromso once.
Oh, yes, I've been there.
It's an amazing little place, yeah. isn't it? It's a great yeah. place. And they offered us the opportunity to do the game behind the glass. Mm. And we said no. It was minus 14.
Well, I have to say, same game, Chelsea-Tromso?
No, I did Tottenham there.
Okay, I did Chelsea there in the Cup Winners' Cup when they had to stop the game about five times to clear
Viali
the snow.
And all that.
That's right. And we were behind glass with a heater. And I have to say, everything I just said about being behind glass does not apply in Tromso. You definitely want to be behind glass in Tromso.
We had sleeping bags. It was brilliant. Great fun. I suppose when you were talking about that, were you talking about Capital Gold times when you were?
Yes, that was Capital Gold times, and I remember we travelled on a bit of a shoestring budget. Rob Watton and I went over to Tromso, and we picked up Jody Morris as our co-commentator on the basis that Capital wouldn't pay for one of our normal guys to go, because it's quite an expensive place to get to. And Jody Morris was about 18 at the time and was a non-playing member of the squad. How badly can I swear on this podcast?
You can do what you like.
Can I? Okay. So if you go back and look on YouTube at the game, you'll see that Tromso did extremely well, and at several points in the game were ahead. I think it might have finished 3-2. And so the first goal goes in, and I describe it, you know, Anderson to Patrickson to whoever it is, whatever, who scores the goal, to which teenage Jody Morris's erudite analysis was, "I scored."
Cheers, mate.
Yeah.
I remember you from those Capital Gold days, because that's what I grew up listening to, Jonathan Pierce.
Yeah.
I remember my dad introducing it to me in about 1987 when it first started on Capital Gold. I think you joined a little bit later than
later,
that.
Yeah.
What made you join Capital? Because you were working in the north, first of all, weren't you?
No, I went to I had two stabs at university, actually. I'll try and make this short, but I went to Surrey University for four terms, very unsuccessfully. But the only thing I did do there was get involved in a university radio station, because I had two loves at 18, basically music and football. And I got involved in the university radio station so I could play my music. So I was a DJ playing all my kind of music.
What were you listening to at the time?
Well, it was a lot of 60s stuff, and you have to remember this was the kind of mid 80s. So
Morrissey?
Not a big Smiths fan in those days, much more so now because my wife is, but you know, the Jam, the Clash and all that kind of stuff. And then going back into stuff like Led Zepp and the Beatles and, you know, that kind of stuff, the Kinks and all that stuff. But anyway, so that was my introduction to radio. And then I went back to university to do an English degree, which I enjoyed much more, where I got involved in Liverpool University at the university newspaper, where I got quite close to my first sort of footballing love, Tranmere Rovers, because I wrote for the university paper about Tranmere Rovers and was lucky enough to go along to lots of Johnny King press conferences and watch some games for nothing, which seemed like amazing. And I suppose it was that I had a bit of a light bulb moment where I actually thought, do you know what? Some people actually make a living doing this. This is a job, actually. This could be a job. So that's when I started sort of pursuing that and applied for various BBC local radio trainee schemes and almost got on one. And lucky enough, there was a guy at Capital Radio I was advised to send a CV off to, who was an ex-BBC guy called Peter Simmons, who was a genius sports producer and now very high up in independent radio. Sort of program controller level, and I think Pete realised that me nearly getting on this graduate trainee scheme was actually a feather in my cap. He realised that more than I did, actually, and invited me in for a voice test and all that stuff, and said, come in and learn what we do on a Saturday afternoon. So for months I was going in on a Saturday afternoon just learning how to edit tape and how old cart machines worked and all that kind of stuff. And I got an enormously lucky break after I'd been doing that unpaid for a while. As I remember, someone was going to Vicarage Road, Watford were playing Swindon, and their motorbike broke down and they rang in the office. It would have been a payphone in those days probably, saying, I can't get my bike to start, I can't get to Vicarage Road. And Pete said, bearing in mind we were at Euston Tower, very close to Euston Station, Pete said, get yourself to Euston, grab a kit, get to Euston, go to Vicarage Road and report, not commentate, report on Watford Swindon. And I think I got paid about a tenner for it. But did well enough to do it again the next week.
That was my first introduction to Capital Gold. I was doing what you did, working behind the scenes, just watching what was happening.
Yeah.
Someone phoned in sick the night before. I remember being in the Wetherspoons pub in Bromley, getting a phone call from someone saying, oh, can you go to Barnet versus Plymouth, I think it was, the next day. Instead, and I had the massive panic attack. And
I didn't get time to panic because it was no, because I probably got the message to go at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for a 3 o'clock kickoff. So no time to panic. But I mean, you earn your breaks, I suppose, Sam, don't you? You know, you earn your breaks because you're in the right place at the right time, and you've shown some ability and talent and persistence to make sure you're in that position when the bike breaks down or somebody's ill or whatever it is, you know, that you're the guy they turn to. So that's interesting.
So how did it change from being at Capital Gold, where you then went on to do commentary and were one of the main presenters alongside Jonathan Pearce, to you ended up, you both working for Match of the Day. But you went first to the BBC.
Yeah, I went first. We had a great team at Capital. It was an amazing place. Me, Jonathan, Rob Watton, obviously Sky now, Julian Waters the same, Dave Clark doing the arrows on Sky now. That was our team, Ian Crocker. That was our team, really, who've all done brilliantly, those guys. They've all done brilliantly. And it was a fantastic learning environment. And also, I guess I felt after the European Championships in 1996 that I had an Olympics in 94, a World Cup in 94, and a European Championship on my CV. And I was still in my 20s. And I thought, this is a good time now to make the next step. And the obvious next step was Five Live. And so I tried really hard to get into Five Live, went for a few fairly sort of daunting BBC boards, interviews as they call them, two or three times, didn't get in. But I had a bit of a champion there and very grateful to him, a guy called Charlie Runcie. And Charlie was very encouraging. And said, you know, you should keep trying. And he said, which was good advice, he said, look, people here know of you, but they don't know you. They've never worked with you. He said, my advice to you would be to leave Capital and go freelance in order that you are working with the senior people here, working for them. And then you've got a better chance of getting a proper job. And he said, if you're willing to go freelance, I will guarantee you 2 days a week work on Five Live. So that was good enough for me. And I picked up work elsewhere. And about 6 months later, they offered me a job. So it worked out.
And then from the Five Live situation, you earned your way into Match of the Day. And then
I was lucky because I got into Match of the Day at a time, you'll remember, John Champion went to ITV from the BBC with the rights. So BBC lost the Match of the Day rights. And actually, in a way, that helped me because John was recruited to ITV. But of course, though we didn't have week-to-week BBC Match of the Day, we did have a World Cup in 2002 to cover, and FA Cup and whatever else. And the team was John Motson, Barry Davis, Tony Gubber, and they were one short for the World Cup. So there was a kind of a beauty contest, if you like, to see who would be, through various Five Live people, who would be the guy who went along as the fourth man to the World Cup in 2002. And, you know, luckily for me, Niall Sloan, now at ITV, decided to give me that gig. And that was quite brave of him in a way, because I'd been at the BBC far less time than most of the other Five Live people who I assume were also under consideration. So through that period of 3 years when the Premier League highlights was the Premiership on ITV, I was doing radio and the little bits of TV that BBC Sports still had. And then once the rights came back to the BBC, which I think was in 2004, I moved full-time onto telly.
Do you find it difficult to do highlights, or do you find it difficult to make the transition from highlights games to live games, as you must have to do over this time of year when you're doing FA Cup matches?
Well, no, because I treat, and this is a highlights game for me today, I treat it as a live game. So I will commentate on, you know, a player being injured and the physio coming on. If that, you know, if the physio's on for 3 or 4 minutes, I will commentate on that, because, you know, 99 times out of 100, that's not going to make an edit. But you'd never know, actually, you know. And also footage of those things, if this becomes a serious injury, may somehow become a story or something, you know. Football Focus might want some words of, you know, might just drop those words into a little feature about that injury. So you just never know. So I just kind of figure that it makes sense to treat it always as if it were a live game. So actually the transition from a highlights game to a live game, the only difference from my point of view is that on a live game I've got a co-commentator, which I'm doing Wolves Liverpool on Monday for the BBC with Jermaine Genus on Monday night. So the only difference is that relationship with a co-commentator, because I don't work with a co-commentator that frequently. So, you know, that's the only adjustment I have to make, really.
I sometimes think, shut up, I've still got quite a lot to say.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the co-coms on the Beeb do a great job, actually. And, you know, Ab Bear, who you are, get battered, largely.
Everyone gets battered.
Get battered. Everybody gets battered, you know. But they do get battered. And I think it's a little bit unfair. I think the prevailing mood at the moment in kind of social media response to football broadcasting, one of the themes of what's going on at the moment is kick the pundit. And I think it's a little bit unfair, actually.
Yeah. You've told us your best FA Cup moment. What was your best moment in broadcasting that you've had?
Oh, well, that's so difficult. I mean, the greatest sporting event I've ever seen, the greatest thing I've ever probably witnessed, and it's not even football, which is weird, because I've got so many fantastic football memories. But for Capital Radio, I commentated on Michael Johnson winning the 200 metres at the Atlanta Olympic Games. And I've still got my commentary on a CD, actually. I'm quite pleased with it, actually. No one's ever really... No one else thought it was
any good.
No. I've put it around, but no one's ever invited me to reprise my athletics career. So, but I've got to tell you, Sam, that 200 metres, I like my athletics. That 200 metres, there was Frankie Fredericks in the final, Atto Bolden in the final, and Michael Johnson. And Michael Johnson's blueprint was the 400 meters. Everyone knew he'd win the 400 meters. The 200 meters, you don't know. It's not his first choice event. And I'll tell you, they broke. And the nature of a 200 is that it's hard to know who's in front until they come into the home straight off the bend. So that's when obviously the lane advantage negates out, and then they are coming out. They've all run the same distance, and it suddenly became apparent that Michael Johnson was absolutely miles ahead of everybody else. And I think he took 0.3 seconds off the world record, which in 200 meters terms is huge. And those kind of times stood, I would imagine, until Usain Bolt came along. You know, it was only Usain Bolt that then took that to the next level. It was an incredible, incredible performance. So that would be my standout sporting moment that I've ever seen. But there are so many great football memories, it's hard to say.
Listen, thank you very much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
And enjoy this afternoon.
Thank you. Brilliant. Cheers. And you.
Cheers. Great to have Steve on the podcast, but even he has never commentated on a load of celebrities trying their utmost not to fall over on an ice rink. Coming up next, Sam's going to tell us what it's like behind the scenes on the opening night of Dancing on Ice, and we will find out, I'm dying to hear about this actually, if Crook succeeded in two matches in one day in different places.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Welcome back to the final part of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Now, much has been made of the new set of kickoff times in the FA Cup this weekend. That follows a big money new deal between the FA and overseas television networks. But, Crook, it did give you the chance to cover two games in the space of just a few hours. This made me nervous even thinking about it. As Sam said last week, it wasn't possible. So did you do it and how did it go?
Do you know what? It was pretty relaxed, actually.
It's not even true.
It was.
So, okay.
Well, there was
the
one
text
hiccup.
Messages he sent me on Saturday afternoon begging me for information about the Blackpool Arsenal game because he hadn't had time to get himself sorted for that match. Should we do that?
There is a subplot to that story. So Sam did send me his facts and his script, and I couldn't believe he'd not mentioned Blackpool Illuminations and Blackpool Tower, and he said, oh, it's too obvious. And then I listened to his commentary of Alex Iwobi's goal, and he used my line. He said it's the Arsenal players who are illuminating Blackpool tonight, stolen from the bloke who didn't do any research.
Yeah. I couldn't believe that. I got a text message from him about 4 o'clock saying, can you send me some stats for the Blackpool game? I've only got four. I said, there's loads out there. Anyway, 4:15, another text. 4:30, another text. Every 15 minutes until I'd sent him my notes.
Yeah, that was probably the lack of prep time was an issue. However, so I covered Bournemouth-Brighton for TalkSport at 12:30. I deliberately parked my car not in the club car park because, as we all know, it's a nightmare getting out straight after a game. So I parked it about a 10-minute walk away. Unplugged, arranged for someone else to record the post-match interviews so that we still have the audio for TalkSport. That was sent to me while I was travelling, forwarded them as I was driving down the M3, got to Woking train station early, actually. I was due on the 4:12. I got there at 1 minute to four and thought, brilliant, I can get the earlier train. But I got on the wrong train. There were two leaving at the same time. So I got on the slow train. So I actually didn't get into Waterloo until 4:45. I was on the air at 5 o'clock. I got to the studio at 5 to 5. Luckily, thanks to Sam, all my prep was done. I had the teams lined up. Away I went.
I can just imagine you running out of Waterloo Station, down those back streets to talk. I can just imagine all of this. I can
sweating.
Imagine you sat on the train with your fist clenched and your jaw clenched, just really cursing life.
Moment
got
of
on
euphoria
the wrong train.
Getting that email from me when I've even written out the teams for you as well.
Aww,
sorted.
True friend.
That was very helpful. And I managed to file a 700-word report for the Sunday Mirror during my train journey as well.
Well, so, good job you got on the slow one, wasn't it?
No wonder he wants to go on the international break.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so that was it. But listen, it wasn't as exciting as Sam's weekend, of course, because he got to watch Gemma Collins and all these minor celebrities
Frenchie?
trying to stay up.
We've got to talk about Frenchie from Greece. I mean, she was fantastic. She was Didi Conn. She's 67 years of age, right? She was wearing the original jacket from the Grease movie, which was recorded in 1977. I mean, and she came out and she gave a great performance, and she's just a lovely person. I mean, 67, taking on ice skating for the first time, that's impressive. But I know you're interested in the big GC. I've got to be honest, right? She was interesting. There was a situation during rehearsals in which she did use an excuse, and I know we're going to talk about managerial excuses for defeats in the next few minutes, but she came out with one of the best excuses I think anyone's ever come out with in terms of falling over at Dancing on Ice. She came out, did a rehearsal, she was skating around, she was just wearing her gym kit, she sort of skated up towards the desk, and I was sitting at the judge's desk watching rehearsals. As she came and skated round, I gave her a smile, just sort of flashed a smile. You know, I'm quite a nice guy most of the time. And she turned round and fell over straight away. Turned round, fell over, went headfirst into the side of the rink. She got up, walked off, didn't see her for the rest of the day. She'd like, that was it. I'm not doing that again, blah, blah, blah. Didn't see her till the Sunday when we were doing the rehearsals again. She came out, she skated up to me, and she said, "You made me fall over on Friday." I said, "What?" She goes, "You made me fall over on Friday." I said, I didn't make you fall over. She went, "You did." I didn't know who you were. I'd never seen your face before. You gave me that big flashy smile and your eyes were there. And all of a sudden, I just lost concentration.
She fancies you.
Yeah. I thought maybe she was flirting with me. You never know.
So you swept her off her feet, literally.
Literally, yeah.
Apparently so, yeah.
This is amazing. And but what's it like sort of with all these, as Crooks says, minor celebrities perhaps, are any of them divas? Does everyone get on? And do you know them all now? Do they know who you are?
I think she's a diva. I think she's quite happy to be characterised as a diva. Yeah, they're all lovely. It's a great atmosphere there. One of the great things I think about doing that sort of show is it takes you into a completely different realm of broadcasting. It's a long day. I left my house at 4 a.m. on both Friday and Sunday. Didn't get back till 10 o'clock at night on both occasions. It's rehearsal after rehearsal after rehearsal. It's watching and studying what they're doing and working out what you're going to say. And what's different about it is that it's ice skating. What's the same about it is you're just talking over pictures about what people were doing. So it's very similar, actually, to doing a football commentary.
But how on earth do you go from football commentary to ice skating? What made you get into this?
They had an emergency. They had a situation where the commentator that they'd employed to do it, Matt Chapman, who did it before, hadn't really ever done commentary, I don't think, and he just couldn't get to grips with it. And they did it one episode last season and decided that it's not the right thing.
No way.
And they rang me up on a Wednesday night, probably about this time last year, actually. It was Wednesday night. It was a half-time in the Carabao Cup semi-final, Arsenal-Chelsea, and said to me, can you come and do it? I was like, no. And I was with Matt Holland, and Matt Holland took me out for dinner afterwards and convinced me to do it. Mm. And the next day, I went to meet them and, went from there.
And you enjoy it, obviously.
I absolutely love it. I think it's challenging, it's different, you meet new people. I got to hang out with Ryan Sidebottom on Sunday night, so that was always quite a bit of fun. And Brian McFadden as well from Westlife. That's one of Crook's heroes, I'm sure of it. He loves Westlife.
I do like Westlife, yeah.
We know he loves
Guilty Pleasure.
Will Young.
Yeah, he loves Will Young. One of the reasons that this podcast was interrupted today was because Crook's Alexa went off because it doesn't know how to use it and started playing a Will Young tune, Evergreen or something.
My favourite Will Young tune. I was just going to say, I used to work, my first paid job was working on the cheese counter, the deli counter at Safeway. I loved it. Love the free food. But I don't think we had as much cheese in the counter as you managed to squeeze into that show on Saturday night, Sam. Some of your lines.
Family audience, mate. You've got to adapt to the people you're broadcasting to. Talking of excuses, should we talk about some of the big excuses that we've had from the football managers this weekend? Because, I mean, I know you've probably got examples of this, but Jurgen Klopp last night after the game against Wolverhampton Wanderers turning around and saying it was the wind. The wind was very difficult. Then suggesting that everyone had flu between the Manchester City game and the game last night. Because that's why you lost. Not the fact that there were three under 19-year-olds in the team.
16-year-olds, weren't there?
It was a 16-year-old. And he was great, by the way. I thought he did really well. And I thought it was actually unfair on those three young players who did okay. Mm. Because other senior players in that team, Daniel Sturridge, Divock Origi, didn't do very well at all.
Yeah, let them down, really. The established players, didn't they? I mean, that's an amazing excuse from Jurgen Klopp. Just come out and say we got beaten by a better side. They never do, don't they? I mean, even Eddie Howe at the weekend was making excuses for his team selections. Nathan Ake is unwell. Callum Wilson not fully fit. If that was a Premier League game, both of those play. You're mugging your fans, you're mugging yourself, you're mugging the club. Just come out and say we were beaten. But, I mean, it is amazing. We've all had managers who come out and just make the most ridiculous excuses. I remember when Portsmouth were going for promotion to the Premier League. They were top of the table. They were going to win the championship. It was just a case of when. It was all geared up. They were playing Sheffield Wednesday at home. If they won, they were champions, or they were promoted anyway. And they lost 2-1. Lee Bradbury, who was on loan from Portsmouth to Sheffield Wednesday, scored the winning goal. And Harry Redknapp was fuming afterwards, red-faced, and he launched a scathing attack on the PA announcer for asking the fans, when Pompey were leading the game 1-0, not to invade the pitch at full time. And he said, oh, he set us up there, you know, the game wasn't over. If he'd not said that, we wouldn't have got beaten. And I thought, really?
Didn't he also say, and I think the guy's name was Steve Pearson, didn't he also read out the Leicester score, which led to them possibly winning the league or getting promoted that day?
Yes, I think he did, yeah.
But that irked Harry as well.
It was the message that asking the fans not to invade the pitch that really got Harry's goat. And on the subject of Fratton Park, I don't know if it counts as an excuse or not, but I was also there when Arsenal were playing a league game. It was a Saturday televised match. There had been a bit of rain. Fratton Park wasn't at the time the best pitch for draining, but the pitch was playable, more than playable. But I watched from the press box, and you may well have been here that day, Sam, and Arsene Wenger frog-marched the referee into the centre circle and basically made him call the game off, even though the pitch was playable, because they had a Champions League semi-final on the Wednesday night.
Well, the stark contrast to that was is that a year beforehand, or maybe even 2 years beforehand, Portsmouth had played Leicester City in a top-of-a-table clash in the Championship on what can only be described as a very shallow swimming pool. So we'd all seen that pitch was playable even when it was under 6 inches of water, and it really was. That game was ridiculous. It should never have continued. But this match that was called off, the Arsenal match, was nothing like that. I mean, it was totally ridiculous. It was complete fudge.
But do these excuses then come back to what we were talking about earlier, that the FA Cup isn't perhaps held in as high regard as it once was? You know, Leicester, Claude Puel not fielding his strongest team. You know, Jurgen Klopp, with respect to the youngsters that went out and did a decent job last night, albeit if you'd had Virgil van Dijk in defence, would they have lost to Wolves?
I can't blame Jurgen Klopp, because they're trying to win the title for the first time in 29 years. I don't think you can have a go at him for that.
I agree.
I think having a go at him for what he said afterwards, or trying to pretend that it was something else, is you know, we're just pointing out that he doesn't need to do that. But what we said right at the beginning of the show was, with the likes of Leicester City, the likes of Bournemouth, teams that are not going to go down, Wolverhampton Wanderers as well, you've got to why isn't the Cup more important than anything else at this stage of the year? Because those clubs aren't going anywhere else. Well, the rest of their season is going to be probably quite a limp and damp affair. The fact is that this was an opportunity for glory, and some teams, Leicester in particular, have spurned that, and that they'll have to answer to their fans ultimately.
I think there's some context. For the first time ever, I was abused by a Bournemouth fan on Twitter after I had a go at Eddie Howe over his team selection on Saturday, and he quoted Manchester United making changes, Burnley making changes, and I said, look, there's some context here, Watford making changes. What, United can make changes and bring in people like Alexis Sanchez. They're allowed to do that, and they won the game. Watford were playing a non-league side. Fair enough, make changes. They won the game. Burnley, of course, are fighting for their lives against relegation. I've got no problem with teams with something to play for making changes. But as you say, if you're Bournemouth or you're Leicester, but Bournemouth in particular, because he does it every year in the FA Cup, what have they got to play for? They've never won a major trophy in their history. They're playing now to finish in the minor positions in the Premier League. And I know Bournemouth fans who stayed away from the game on Saturday. And I'm a big Eddie Howe fan. I've got no malice against Eddie Howe, but this is his blind spot. He thinks finishing one or two places higher in the Premier League is more important than going on a cup run, going to Wembley for the first time. They've never even played in a semi-final in a major cup competition. Fans remember cup runs. They don't remember if you finished 11th or 16th in the Premier League.
And then the cup draw, of course, Sam, I know you were doing that on TalkSport. I was doing that on Sky Sports News. And you couldn't help but feel a little bit for those so-called smaller teams that had got through. Barnet, 15th in the National League, literally fell to the floor when they fell. They were found out they were going to play Brentford, Newport away to Borough. It hasn't thrown up the fourth round of fixtures that some neutrals might have hoped for.
I was disappointed sitting there watching it, because I was hoping that we were going to get that draw. I mean, the best one possibly is Frank Lampard and Derby, if they get past Southampton, going to Accrington. That might be a great story. AFC Wimbledon and West Ham, we've already had that once this year, haven't we, in the League Cup, and West Ham annihilated them. I was a bit disappointed. I mean, I think Arsenal Manchester United is going to be a fantastic game of football. It might not be the kind of thing we want in a
cup competition.
We get it week in, week out, and we probably in the FA Cup are looking for something a little bit more romantic.
Exactly.
But I think
it's
the game will be
both
brilliant
for those sides, though, isn't it?
It'll be brilliant.
It is their best chance of a
football
trophy.
And we talked about Unai Emery. You talked about other managers resting players, etc., etc. Emery rested all his players, and he played loads of kids, but ultimately they won. And he said, "Look, I can give opportunities to kids, but there's one stipulation. We have to keep winning." And they did do that. And I think, that again goes back to what we were saying a little bit earlier.
They're going to do well to sell this round of fixtures to TV companies. You know, 70 countries took Bournemouth, Brighton on Saturday, which is incredible. I don't think 70 countries are going to be taking Barnet against Brentford with the greatest respect in the world. But the worst thing for Barnet and for Portsmouth was that they were two of the last sort of half a dozen teams left in there, along with Manchester United, Arsenal and Spurs. And it looked for all the world that they would get that plum tie, and then Pompey got QPR, and as you said, Barnet against Brentford.
And back to league actions, league action this weekend. Sam, you seem to have been at every game going recently, but where are you going to be this weekend as well as the ice rink?
Well, tonight, and you've very pleasantly come to see me today. This is our first meeting, look, and we're at Wembley.
People will start talking.
But this is good, though, isn't it? You know, our first ever meeting was at the home of football. Look at that. So I'm at Wembley because it's Chelsea-Tottenham tonight, and then tomorrow night, Manchester City against Burton. And then I'm not doing a game at the weekend.
Why is that?
Because we just don't have one. We don't have a commentary this weekend, so
you can concentrate on your ice skating.
I can concentrate on my ice skating.
What about you, Crook? Where are you?
I'm looking forward to it, actually. I'm doing Brighton-Liverpool alongside Ray Parlour for TalkSport on Saturday. And I think this is a tricky game for Liverpool, particularly on the back of two successive defeats. Again, like Manchester City, people were talking about them being invincible, going the season unbeaten. Well, they've lost two games in a row in League and Cup now. And Brighton are the last team, particularly Amex, you want to play in those circumstances because they make it so difficult. They stifle the life out of the opposition. Duffy and Dunk will head everything away. They're going to be tackles flying in. I think this is a huge test of Liverpool's championship aspirations.
Yeah, look, that's a good game to be at. I'm at Bristol City v Bolton, so not perhaps as exciting. But what's weird about that is they've got to play again in a couple of weeks in the FA Cup fourth round, that exact tie.
It's interesting. They've started to get a bit better, haven't they, Bristol City?
Yeah, they're unbeaten, I think, in eight, maybe nine now after the Huddersfield game. But they're on this unbeaten run. They've picked up a few wins. Obviously, they're taking another Premier League scalp. They're so good at doing this. They did it in the League Cup several times last year. Beat Watford, beat Stoke when they were in the Premier League. Obviously, beat Manchester United. And now they've got that favourable draw in the fourth round, so maybe they could go in on a cup run. I don't see them getting promoted in the Championship, so perhaps a nice little FA Cup run for them this season.
That'll make Lee Johnson happy, won't it? Easier to interview afterwards.
I'll just say hopefully.
Good stuff.
Right, that's all we have time for on the first All Football Commentators of Geeks of 2019. Thanks as ever for listening. We'll all be back with another special guest from the world of sports broadcasting next week.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.